Jeanette from DC area.
Hi, guys.
Hello.
My name is Monette. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
Thank you, Bill, for asking me to be here. Of course, that's my authentic self speaking, because my alcoholic self wants to be like, I don't want to be here. But I'm here. It's part of what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous is we take uncomfortable actions, because this is not something I actually like doing. I'm actually the kind of alcoholic who doesn't like telling my story either, because if it were up to me, I would love to just forget where I've come from. You know, but I'm fortunately part of a group of alcoholics who tell me I can't do that. You know, I can't afford to forget where I've come from. So with that said, I have a sobriety date. It's June 25th of 2017. I have a home group. It's called Midtown. We meet in Bethesda, Maryland, which is pretty far away tonight. And I have a sponsor. Her name is Joyce. So, with all that said, we usually, in my home group, will say we're nervous, and everybody will just be like, "Aw," and I'm just going to say that for everybody, yeah, because yeah, I'm kind of nervous. Thanks. So, my home group meets, you know, like I said, on Sunday nights, and we have a group of, like, over 400 people that... You know, and it's when I was speaking in front of them, you would think that would be so much more terrifying. But I think the whole act of just speaking in front of people, just being honest and just becoming vulnerable is just terrifying in and of itself. And then to top it off, I have to do it for an hour. So it's kind of like, well, I don't get to cut corners this time. So I'll just jump right in. I'm from D.C., Northwest, a little part of D.C. called Chevy Chase. I don't know if any of you guys know the area. But, yeah, I grew up there, and my family was dysfunctional, to keep it, you know, real. They were alcoholics. My parents were alcoholics. And, you know, at an early age, I was able to see that my restlessness, my irritability and discontentedness that the Big Book describes was manifesting itself. My mom found me underneath the dining room table one day trying to stage a suicide. I had my arm out and a butter knife on the floor with some ketchup all along my arm. And my mom walks downstairs. She sees the ketchup bottle and she's like, "Monette, get up." You know, like, what are you doing? No, it's like that was my first memory of, like, actually just trying to, you know, explain to my parents, you know, that I just felt wrong. You know, I was just really, really off. And that was, you know, I was about 7 or 8. So it was preceded my first drink by only a couple years, though, mind you. Because one day when my parents left me home alone, I was about 10 or 11. I found a bottle of peach schnapps in my dad's liquor cabinet and I drank it. And I don't remember exactly what happened, if anything special that night, but what I do remember is that the next day, what I now know is the phenomenon of craving had been activated, because I went looking for that bottle after that night and I didn't find it. My dad must have found out that I drank it, and we didn't have a conversation. Nothing happened from it, but I just know from that day on, he never left booze out in plain sight for me to have access to ever again. So needless to say, at 10 or 11, I couldn't exactly access alcohol very easily. So I just went on, you know, just expressing my restlessness, my irritability and discontentedness in other ways, which manifested itself just so strangely. Like in elementary school, I went to the eye nurse, the doctor or whatever, the, you know, doctor at school, and I took an eye exam. And I faked it to the point to where the nurse had to call my mom and say, "I think your daughter's either blind or she's lying to get glasses." We don't know why she would do this, but I was doing it because I wanted to, like, fit in with my friends. You know, my friends all had glasses, which kind of might explain a little bit about, you know, the kind of person that I had to actually be, because none of the girls liked me in my school growing up. And I think it might have something to do with because, well, the boys would chase me around and would play tag and touch, you know, like tap me on my back. And then as soon as I turn around, they'd freeze because they said I was so ugly that when they looked at me, they turned to stone. They called me Medusa. I know. But see, and now looking back, I know that it was probably because I was kind of like a cute little girl. And so they would like go out of their way, you know, to like, but I didn't know that. So I went to school like within the next couple weeks after that started happening, wearing my mom's tube shirt as a skirt. And so the girls didn't like that because it drew a lot of attention. So they then started having an I Hate Monette Club at my school. They had a president, a vice president, a secretary, and a treasurer, all to talk about how much they hated me after school. So, I mean, as you could see, this is all very confusing, none of which any of this makes me an alcoholic by any means. But it did contribute, I believe, to the ticking time bomb that was just waiting to happen. You know, that just that tightening screw that I've heard people talk about that just, you know, needed the comfort and the ease of alcohol. So I found that right around 15, 16 years old, I started getting, you know, along with a crew, literally, they were a crew of people who called themselves the BFC crew. It was like this whole like little gang wannabe thing. We used to tag our names on things and I had to like fight girls to get into it. It was great. You know, it was wonderful because I got to, you know, take out the aggression that I had at home out on other people. And they drank and they smoked pot. So that was just like the items of a perfect storm. But it put me at ease finally. You know, I was really able to finally just take a deep breath and, you know, enjoy life. I was able to get back into dancing because I started off in gymnastics when I was little, put all that down, you know, because there was just too much chaos happening in my head. And I was able to get back into it because drinking allowed me to have these, you know, these exterior like rough walls just kind of just be removed. I got involved in other things, but this is an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, so I don't, you know, I just choose to respect that, you know, it's other substances, right? But those other substances did very quickly cause me to get locked up at 17. I was arrested twice in the same week for possession of this other substance. And the court stepped in and said, you know, you need to go to NA or AA and then do this outpatient program that I did. But I was still using this other substance and my levels were going down, but only because I was able, I like worked the system. You know, I mean, I was an alcoholic. I was good at being able to manipulate others. And I showed up to my classes every day, but I still showed up, you know, intoxicated. And they still let me pass. But I knew then. The seed was planted. I knew I was indefinitely an alcoholic. I knew when everybody would share about the experiences that they had and the consequences that they were facing didn't seem to register to me. It didn't even matter. I just knew that it didn't matter what I needed to do to get intoxicated at that point. I didn't care what consequences were coming my way either. I just knew it was like, you know, it was a done deal at that point. So at 17 again, you know, I went to my first meeting and I did find, you know, a group of young people because that was suggested for me to find. And I didn't do what they told me to do. I cherry picked the program. You know, I didn't do steps, but I had a sponsor who I called, you know, and or I wouldn't go to meetings, I would go to meetings and I wouldn't call my sponsor. You know, I never did everything the way the program told me to do it. So needless to say, you know, I wish I was standing here with 20 years sober, but that's just not the case. It took me a lot. And my 20s and my early 30s are a very dark, dark, dark place for me to ever even try to revisit. So I'll do my best because, you know, like I said, I have an hour or so, or not anymore, thank God. So at around like 22, something like that, I met my first now ex-husband in a meeting, at a marathon meeting on Christmas Eve. And I thought it was destiny, you know, because we met at a meeting, which was in a church, and it was on Christmas Eve. And I had been praying up to this point for, like, the man of my dreams to come into my life. And actually, I said that prayer quite a few times since I was six. So, like, I mean, talk about, like, wanting and needing some external person and things to fix me, you know, to fix that God-sized problem or God-sized hole. So we met and we got married within 8 months later, you know, and my first son was born 10 months later. after that day. That was in 2005. And we did not stay sober throughout any of that. Like, I mean, my whole family was very approving of this marriage because they really thought that that would fix me. Again, I'm raised by alcoholics, alcoholics who don't have a solution, who aren't a part of Alcoholics Anonymous, who would love to see that their daughter could just be fixed by this person or this situation, you know, which just clearly didn't happen. Because I would then do what the book describes. I would put down vodka and pick up wine, or, you know, I mean, just the insanity of it, you know. And I thought, well, I can't drink while I'm pregnant because, you know, that would just be horrible, but I can smoke weed, you know, like, sorry, I could do other substances anyway. But the insanity that precedes that first drink for me was always, you know, it was always just justifying and making excuses of why I should be allowed to feel better. You know, I've heard other people talk about how if you only knew how alcohol made me feel, you would never try to take it away from me, which is so true. Because without it, I was just a ball of stress. I fought with my husband at the time, all the time, you know, and like I would take things out on my parents and my family. It was really bad. But we were living out in the mountains out in Winchester, which was strange for me in and of itself, because like I said, I'm from D.C., and I, again, thought that geographical cure would fix me because I'm so removed away from anybody, all the bars, all the people that I've been accustomed to, you know, hanging out with. And that didn't fix me at all. If anything, it actually made me get a lot, lot worse because I was then even further removed and disconnected from any help that I, you know, God was trying to give me at the time, you know, early on. So we broke up and, you know, got back together. It was just, you know, a mess, a toxic ball of mess. And so after, in between that, I then met my second future ex-husband at a meeting, go figure. Because I'm like, I keep on trying to go back to these meetings and say like, you know, I need help. Please just help me stay sober. And they're like, okay, we can, but you have to do X, Y, Z, A, B, C first. And I would just jump to why, you know, literally I'd ask why, like, why am I doing this? You know, I don't get how going to this meeting, listening to somebody talk about their story is going to help me. It can't. There's no way. And so I literally would just close off myself. So there was a lot of in and outs in my early 20s, in and out of the rooms. Now with that second now ex-husband, it was another really dark, dark time in my life. Again, this is a person that I thought would fix me. He had almost a year sober, you know, and I'm thinking, well, great, at least somebody can be level-headed in our relationship. And that was not even slight remotely the case, because the first fight we had, he was off, you know, drinking and brought booze home later on that night, and I'm drinking too. You know, it's just when I sat down and I did my first step with my sponsor, it was so prevalent what the patterns were. And like, it was just so consistent throughout, even to now, I can see myself trying to fall back into that old behavior of thinking that he'll fix me or she'll fix me or that'll fix me. And it just, you know, just doesn't work that way. So that relationship, you know, got, again, very toxic and just very, just was really, really, just really, really bad. You know, there was abuse, physical and verbal, on both of our ends, which I know now from having done a thorough fifth step is the case. Like, I was never really just a victim. You know, I put myself in those situations. Yes, it's not right that, you know, actions that were done to me, but I was not by any means, stretch of the imagination, an angel. You know, and I kept going back for more. So that's my part, you know, and I'm able to see that now. Thank God to this program. So I don't get to live with that resentment. I don't have the luxury to live thinking, woe is me, poor me, pour me another drink. Because that's where that'll get me, you know, when I start thinking that way. So we had a second child together within all this toxicity, you know, within all this, this just chaotic relationship. Because again, that'll fix me. That'll fix us, right? It'll get us closer together. There's no way I'll drink and I'll drug during this pregnancy thinking it'll be different. Again, total insanity. Continuing to repeat the same things and expecting different results. So I had Dylan, my second son, lost custody of him almost immediately, 10 days after he was born, because he was positive to substances. I couldn't keep myself sober through that pregnancy. I couldn't do it. And again, this is part of the reason why I literally hate telling my story, because these are not the things I like to stand up here and admit. But if I don't, I don't get to keep what I have today, which is literally priceless. And I'll get to that. But so his grandmother, my now 9-year-old son's grandmother, took custody of him. And I'm like literally livid at her, thinking, you know, she's the monster, right? She's who's doing this. Can't see anything about what I'm doing to cause this behavior. And again, I don't expect anybody here to be able to relate to the exact, you know, experiences that I've gone through as an alcoholic, but the feelings of just continuing to do the same things and literally expecting different results. And thinking too that, like, you know, the world owes me something. You know, that's just a terrible place to be, thinking that because my parents did this to me, or you know, he did this to me when I was 14, or whoever, whatever situation did this to me, it doesn't matter. Like, it really doesn't. What matters is that thankfully we have a solution, you know. And again, I know that now, and I knew that then too, which was even harder, because after the seed was planted at such an early age, I knew there was a solution out there, which was even making my drinking and my drugging that much more excruciating, because it was like shutting up the voices of AA and like filling it up with, you know, the insatiable, you know, pleasures of alcohol and other substances. It's a very exhausting chore of a life to live, you know, having to constantly shut up those voices, especially having known, like I said, that you guys were available. But I just, you know, when I would run into people in my home group outside, and like, because they're very, I mean, like most meetings when they congregate outside of churches, you know, and I'm driving down, if you guys know anything about DC, I'm driving down Connecticut Avenue. There's a very big group of people outside on Wednesday nights or Thursday nights called choir. And I would drive past that meeting so many times on my way to the bars, on my way back from copping or drinking or doing whatever I was doing. And it was so just unbearable having to literally be like, I'm crying. Again, my authentic self is crying out to please just like come, you know, scoop me up. But my authentic self is just not having it. So needless to say, after having been in and out a little bit more after my second son was born, me and that second husband decided to try it all over again, you know, just have another third kid. I hate to say it like that, but like, it's the insanity that my disease chose to manifest itself in, is that I became a baby maker. I don't know. Like, it was like, it was one of those things where it's like, this will fix me, you know? And every time I had another child, it was like, please just let this time be different. You know, let this time be it. I can't go through it again. I can't go through the loss, you know, the feeling of having a child and not being able to take it home from the hospital. It's like, it could be enough to pretty much break anybody. I mean, but not this alcoholic, right? Like, I was just too, out there. I was too stubborn. I was too, you know, just stuck in my ways. I didn't want to do what Alcoholics Anonymous told me I had to do to stay sober. So what do you think happened again? Of course, once again, I lost custody of him. Now I was actually able to have him, free of any substances or any kind of, you know, any kind of exposure to alcohol, because I checked myself, or I got, admitted into a residential program for women. And the problem with that, it would have been great if it was just women, but then there was like this like neighboring recovery center that was for men who were all convicted of felonies, who were like swapping out prison time for recovery or for, you know, for treatment. So they were there and we're living there, and it's just like, yeah. So I think you guys can kind of, you know, imagine what happened. I wound up finding, you know, the first guy that would fix me there. And we wound up, you know, just like goofing off. And when I should have been focusing on the program, and I should have been focusing on, you know, what to do afterwards to keep myself in a space of, you know, of serenity and making sure my baby was taken care of, that kind of thing, I was focusing more on him and the life we'd have together. So I got kicked out, and I didn't get to leave with my son, is pretty much what happened. And that was, too, it was, that was one of those things where it became obvious to me at that point that, like, the world just hated me. The world was literally against me. Nobody wanted me really to succeed, because if they would have, they wouldn't have put me in a residential program that was right there next to guys. Like, it was just the insanity of thinking that, you know, that this was how it was all set up. Like, I'm set up to fail, you know, and it's that insanity again. So, fast forwarding, my early 30s were pretty much just as bad, but I wound up meeting a woman who, I'll explain a little bit about, and you'll know why towards the end of my story. Her name is Angela Hansen. She was a pastor at the time and a family lawyer. And all I knew about her was that she had a women's house for recovery, or a women's house, you know, yeah, for women who were in recovery. And I had checked myself into a psych ward. You know, that was like my other go-to, by the way, because I don't know if any of you guys remember, but there was a blizzard that happened, I don't know, like 10 years ago, something like that. I don't even remember, but it was a few years ago. And I saw it coming. Well, everybody saw it coming, but like what I saw really happening was the liquor stores were about to be closed. I was like, no, that can't happen. Not to me. I will literally go through DTs. So I had to check myself into the closest psych ward and tell them I was going to kill myself. And I meant it, like literally meant it. Cause I'm thinking while, you know, telling them this, that I will kill myself if I don't have alcohol, if I have to go another 4 or 5 days without it, there's no way I'll be able to make it through that. I couldn't tell them that though. There was this whole system where you had to tell people, you had to tell these people at the hospitals that you have a plan. I don't know if anybody in here, like if you ever need to use that, if that's vital information for you to need to know, hopefully it's not. But when you go into a psych ward, you have to tell them that you have a plan, and it can't be that you just want to drink yourself to death, unfortunately. So I knew better than to tell them that. I came up with this whole, like, you know, which is great for an alcoholic like me, because then I have an even better reason to be able to fantasize, about, or make up some kind of story. So, I don't know why I went into that, but the psych ward thing, but it was a go-to for me, a big go-to. So anyway, right around, in my early 30s. Okay. That's why. Yeah. And I called this woman, Angela Hansen, who I knew she had a house. And as soon as I heard her voice, it was like I was hearing the mom that I never had on the other line. It was like an immediate connection. Her and I connected in a way that I can only explain as like the language of the heart that the big book talks about, you know, and it was like a God, instant connection. And she said to me the most magic words. She said, baby, I think you should come home. And I'm like, who is this stranger? How is she? Like, why is she going to just tell me to come home? She's never met me, you know, but she said, and later on, now I know that she also felt the same thing from me, you know, and she's in recovery. She's 18 years sober now. So anyway, I moved in with her. I got a little bit more substantial, sobriety time, you know, around that time. And she, like I said, was a family lawyer. So she was able to then help me go into the process of like getting custody back of my children. You know, it was just like total God thing. And, I would love to say that once again, you know, that was 8, 9 years ago, that I'm standing here with 9 years sober, but it's just is not the case. Again, I'm sober today. I'm a very sick and stubborn alcoholic. So I stayed there for a few months, you know, and I met another guy who, again, I thought would fix me. Luckily, this is the last kid, so you guys don't have to hold on for too much longer. But so we you know, we met, and it was like, again, it was just, oh my God, he's the one, you know, he has to be the one. And we just ripped and ran, and you know, we did what alcoholics do, you know, together, and it was very bad. And I had my fourth child, my daughter, and I had to go through the whole insanity again, the whole thing again, lost custody of her. This time it was through the state. The state stepped in and said, we are taking her and you're going to have to sign over your parental rights. And I did that. But this time I did it, you know, to the woman who I was telling you about, Angela Hansen. She took parental rights of my daughter. So she had, you know, gainfully inherited parental rights of my daughter legally. And today, that's such a huge blessing. Then it was the most, one of the hardest things I ever had to do. But luckily, this is the near end of, you know, my insanity, or at least for that part of, you know, drinking. But I wound up going to jail right after she was born for something that my dad said I did, but I didn't do. Mind you, I'm not one of those people who likes, who will say I didn't do it when I did it. I've done so many things throughout my drinking career that I should have been caught for and should have been locked up for and never actually, you know, got caught for. But this was something that was, you know, it was spoofed up. And mind you, needless to say, I wound up having to do a 6-month bit in DC jail, which was horrifying. And the case kept getting prolonged and, you know, continued. And while I was in there, my mom came, not my mom, sorry. That's what I've grown to call her, Angela Hansen. She came in to see me, and because she's a pastor, so she has rights to be able to come into a jail. And she told me Ben, who was my daughter's father, had died of an overdose. And it occurred to me at that moment, I don't know if it was like my first spiritual experience, you know, without before having an actual spiritual experience now that I have from doing the steps, where I was like, oh my God, that's why I'm here. That is exactly why I'm here. I understood then that God had a plan for me, you know, and that he didn't intend for me to be out there using the same substances with my daughter's father that could have killed me, that would have killed me, you know, because after finding out toxicology reports and all that, it was indefinitely tainted with. So I would have been dead for sure. And so at that moment, I really, 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 I had vowed to myself. And again, I read in the big book so many times, you know, how many times did we vow to ourselves that we would never drink again? And there we found ourselves with a bottle in our hand without even realizing it, you know. Bless you. And that happened when I got out of jail. I wound up going right to the liquor store without even a thought, with it, forgetting about that spiritual experience that I just had and realizing that God had a plan for me. I couldn't even explain to you why or what the justification was. All I know is it's today because I'm an alcoholic and I am of the hopeless variety who, without a solution, is doomed to drink. And I didn't have a solution then. You know, I knew the solution was readily available, but I didn't have it because I wasn't practicing it. So I just, you know, went on autopilot, went to the liquor store. That spiraled me into about a few months of, you know, of again, just being out there and drinking and drugging. And until, luckily, the very last time that actually, it was not the last time. That sucks. But on Christmas, I was supposed to be there to see my son meet his sister for the first time, my daughter. And I slept through that. I was so hungover from the night before that I slept through an extremely important meeting with my kids, you know. And at that moment when I woke up, I felt that incomprehensible demoralization that the book talks about. It was so unbearable to literally lay there and realize what a piece of, you know what, that I had become, you know, to allow the drinking to take me into such a just extreme state of just demoralization was just beyond me. So I got myself up and I said, you know, not, I can't live like this anymore, because I had lost, you know, I mean, not that they were really too much worth losing over, but my husbands, cars, jobs, you name it, you know, I lost it on the outside, but it was something about that day that I would ever have lost on the inside, where I literally felt like I would not be the lucky one to die from this illness. Like when that occurred to me, you know, that other people were dropping like flies around me, you know, not just from alcoholism, but from other, you know, well, same, I think that it's actually the same illness. It just manifests with other substances, but you know, people were dropping like flies and I literally was the one still standing. And I'm like, that's not going to be me. I don't get to be the lucky one who gets to die from this illness. Rather, I'll be the one who gets to suffer through the rest of my life like this. And when that occurred to me, that's when I said, you know, something literally got to change, has to change. And I know that that was, you know, the God of my understanding speaking to me at that moment. And I got up and I checked myself into another psych ward, but this time it was by the direction of my doctor, who was at the time prescribing me lots of medication. I mean, for everything under the sun, because if you tell me what's going to get me what kind of drugs, I can fit into that diagnosis really easily. I can be anxious. I can be ADHD. I can be schizophrenic if you need me to be. If it needs to, if it can get me good medication, I'll fill it out. You know, I'll tell you all about it. So he was giving me just, you know, a backpack full of medication. And I had to tell him, you know, that I not only needed help getting off that medication, because for me, an alcoholic like me can't take something as prescribed. Like, I just can't, you know, and it's take as needed too at that. I need it all the time. How are you going to tell me take as needed? I need it now. I'm going to need it in 5 minutes. I'm going to need it in 5 hours. I'm always going to need it. So I had to tell him, I had to get honest with him. And that was, you know, that was the start of something that I am familiar with today as, you know, just doing something outside of what I'm familiar with. Being honest with another human being is so unfamiliar for an alcoholic like me. But I, you know, chose to do it, and that got me into treatment after that, which was out, you know, in, where was that, on the Eastern Shore in Maryland. And I didn't do that as a geographical cure, mind you, not this time, because I was literally out. I was out of all of my ideas. So I knew now to have the, you know, to at least have the willingness to listen to somebody else's direction. And they directed me to go to this treatment center. So I did. And then when I was in there, they also directed me to go to a women's recovery house. And that was, again, not something I wanted to do. You know, I don't want to live in a recovery house outside of, or it was like 2.5 hours away from where I grew up. But I did it. And that's my point is, you know, I had to do things that were different. And then when I got there and the director told me I had to get a sponsor, I did it. And when my sponsor told me I had to call her, I did it. And when my sponsor told me, you know, we have to meet on this day to read out of the big book, you know, I did it, you know. And then when she told me to go and, well, she told me to stay out of relationship for the first, you know, at least 90 days. I didn't do that. But, but you know, at least I had, you know, something had changed. And also, honestly, on my defense, at least I knew that I wasn't looking for this relationship to fix me this time. You know, I stayed very vocal with her, and I stayed very, you know, and I did a lot of soul searching. And I had, you know, said to myself at one point that, you know, this is not going to work because I'm doing it out of convenience. That was like a huge part for me to realize that, you know, like I can't use people. It's not fair. It's not fair to use people and to treat them like they're, in, you know, dispensable at our disposal. And that was like a huge growing part and point in my recovery, is to just realize that, you know, people weren't meant for that in my life, at least not from my perspective anymore, that we're not supposed to look at each other like my means to an end. You know, you're my means to get to my end. And I stopped being able to do that with comfort. You know, it made me feel so uncomfortable when I treated people like that, that, you know, that was something that started to change. So with that sponsor, I also decided to talk about, after having been in that house for a year, started to talk to her about the idea of me moving back down here, or, you know, there where I'm from in D.C., because I wanted to be back with my kids. I wanted to be back around them. But I also knew that I couldn't just make an impulsive decision and just jump on, you know, the first opportunity I had to see them. I had to do it, you know, with a sponsor's direction. And she agreed that it was time that I start to try to insert myself back into a fellowship around here. I'll just say around here to make it easy, but you guys know what I mean. To, you know, get a sponsor. Well, around here, and to, like those were the two main things she said. You know, you got to get a home group, got to get a sponsor, and then we'll talk about, you know, where you're supposed to live after you find those things. And so I started to do that, and I went occasionally to D.C. and back to Eastern Shore, Maryland, you know, on a couple weekends, and And, you know, and then I first, then I had, then I saw my son, my 13, my, he's now 13. He was 11 then for the first time after seeing him in a couple years. And that was one of those times where I'm really grateful that I waited for God and not did it on my own time. Because if had I not taken the initiative, or had I taken the initiative to do it earlier, I don't think I would have ever been able to, you know, get through that. Because it kicks up so much guilt, so much shame. You know, it kicked up a lot of just regret, remorse, everything, you know, the big book describes now. That luckily after it was about a year that I had sober, maybe about 8 months, that I was able to confront that, you know, and confront my son. And now, you know, and then listen to him crying to me, literally crying and saying how much he was angry at me. And I'm allowing him to be angry at me. I mean, today, and I was then. You know, you're allowed, okay, but it comes with fine lines, right? Like, you're allowed to be angry, but you're not allowed to talk to me like that. Like, that's, like, the new thing that we have to work on. But then, you know, before he was living with me, he was still living with his grandparents, I had to allow him to feel safe with me. You know, I had to give him that sanctuary from a mom that he never got before, or that he hadn't had in quite a few years. So that has been a working relationship in progress. My other two boys, my now 9-year-old and my 7-year-old, I unfortunately don't get to see them yet. And I say yet with a lot of certainty because I do have faith in a higher power today that will allow me to see them when in God's time, not in my time, which again, I have the proof now to see that that is so true. It couldn't be more true that it happens in God's time, not our time. Because, and I have I don't have a predecessor, but there's a predecessor in my home group that spoke to me very candidly when I first started coming to him about my like problems with not being able to see my children. He said, "Monette, do you realize if you had all four of your kids right now, you would drink?" Like, and I was just like, yeah, probably. You're probably right. But I still want them. You know, I still want to see them. And he's like, and that might be very, very well be the case, but God's preparing you, you know, and you just have to have faith in that. And I know that God is preparing me for a lot of things. My 4-year-old daughter and I have a beautiful relationship. No, she doesn't call me her mom. That was the hardest part for me to get over, but it doesn't matter. Like, it literally doesn't matter. She loves me in a way that nobody else gets to feel. And her adopted mom, Angela Hansen, told me this, you know, countless times. She says that my daughter and your daughter, she now is like open to allowing us both to mother her, you know, is just so blessed to have so much love around her. And God knew what was happening in that situation. God was in it. You know, I didn't know. I couldn't have planned that. You know, I couldn't have planned the life that she has today. And I'm so grateful for that. It took a lot to get to the point of gratitude, you know, a lot of thorough step work and a lot of crying, angry, screaming phone calls made to my sponsor about why does this have to be happening? Why can't she just be, you know, why can't it just be different? You know, why this, why that, why? It just doesn't matter. It just is what it is. We're supposed to accept things for how they are and, you know, and deal with it, you know? And it's just one of those things that almost like literally just saying that takes a burden off me from thinking that I have any kind of right or reason for that matter to control a situation. We don't get to do that, nor do we. I even want to, because I don't want to have to try to control the outcome of situations. I'm so grateful that I have a God that can do all that work for me, you know, and all I have to do is show up and allow God to make things happen, you know, and do the best of my ability to allow God to work through me while doing that. So just to cover a little bit about the steps, like I said in the beginning of my share, when me and my sponsor went over my first step, it was so prevalent what my patterns were, you know, but there I was back in a relationship, you know, at the time of reading the first step. And she said, okay, well, if, and this is my now sponsor, the one I had after my sponsor on the Eastern Shore, who told me to get a new sponsor anyway. So she said, had I been sponsoring you at the time of you getting into this relationship, I'd probably have told you not to. But since you are, we're going to go with it, and you're just going to have to work a lot harder. And I was confronted with that as like, it's on. Let's do this. Wait, I can do this. Of course I can do it. I've done so many other things, right? Well, so she, needless to say, I didn't realize the work that I'd be putting her through too on a daily basis. Because on an almost daily basis, I have to call her about insecurities, you know, about fears, about stressors, about just like, you know, it's hard being in a relationship with other people, let alone, you know, a companion, a person that you share space with and you share a life with. And, you know, it's hard. And I know it says, I know I'm not the only one, because it talks about it in the big book that it's relationships are difficult areas for us. You know, they really are. And I know that works all around the boards, not just in intimate ones, but in friendships. You know, it took me the longest time to actually be able to open up to another woman and allow her in and to get to know me, because I had so many associates and acquaintances throughout my life, but I would never actually let somebody in to know the real me, you know. And now that I'm doing that, it feels really good. It does. And that just the act of being sponsored and being and sponsoring other women too, it's just it's a beautiful thing how this program works and how, you know, I'm able to actually hear God speak when I'm speaking to my sponsees. It's the strangest thing, because I'll be talking to them and I'll be like, oh my God, thanks God, like, you just gave me advice, but I was able to give it to somebody else and I was able to hear my voice saying it. Just it's a beautiful thing. Just like I'm able to hear my sponsor. That's why I chose her as a sponsor, because I'm able to hear her. You know, she can get through to me. She's known in our home group as the tough one. You know, I think anybody could hear her. She's kind of just one of those, well, that, and she's a prosecutor. So, you know, I don't like, I don't want to mess with her. But, yeah, no, she's great. And I owe her my life. And anytime I try to tell her that, she's like, oh, it's thank you for being willing. I'm like, why do you have to be so humble and so modest? Jeez, just say you're welcome. But she won't. She won't take credit, you know, which is what I know now is, you know, it's a good spiritual principle to have, you know, that humility, because that's what's going to keep us sober when we don't take the credit for our sobriety, when we give it to God, you know, because that is who I choose to call my higher power today. And it's who I give all the credit for. I wouldn't have the life I have today if it weren't for God. And on some days, that's not always a good thing. I don't always like my life. I like to complain about my life. I like to complain about my job and about my 13-year-old boy and his hormones and how he's a 13-year-old boy, you know. It's just like, and then other days, you know, I'm so grateful to have the opportunities that I have. Like I said, when I first started this week, I thank you so much for asking me to be here. And that's my authentic self speaking, because my alcoholic self wanted nothing to do with, I wanted to try to get out of this in so many different ways, but Billy was so nice and friendly. He had to keep texting me occasionally like, so you're still coming, right? I'm like, yep. Yep. I'm still coming. So, but yeah, if it weren't for this program, I wouldn't have the life I have today. I don't really know what else to say other than, thank you so much for having